Hi everyone, welcome back to the Fens Cast. This is your monthly podcast from Fens, where we discuss some of the most interesting and current topics in neuroscience. This week, we're joined by Kanika Rajan, who is a computational neuroscientist and associate professor at the Friedman Brain Institute at the Icahn School of Medicine in Mount Sinai, New York. Her research looks at how important cognitive functions like learning and memory and decision making emerge from the cooperative activity of multiscale neural processes. She applies computational frameworks derived from machine learning and statistical physics to uncover integrative theories about the brain that bridge neurobiology and artificial intelligence. Hi, Kanika. You're very welcome to the podcast. Can I just ask you, first of all, how did you become interested in AI in the first place?
I took a circuitous path to neuroscience. So for me, the interest is initially it began with this notion that, oh my God, it was all going to be video games and fun. So I think that's sort of how it started. But now I see this explosive pace of innovations on the artificial intelligence side. And I feel strongly compelled to connect the field of neuroscience, which I'm a part of, and the exploration and the fundamental search for natural intelligence with innovations in that field. So I would like that cross-pollination to be tighter than it currently is. And so that's what currently drives my interest.
And I think, as you said there's been a real explosion in AI in the last few years, really. What's driven that, do you think?
I think we're at this perfectly poised. For the first time in history, we're poised at the special point, right? Where somehow computations are not as expensive as they used to be. The algorithms have gotten extremely powerful. We're no longer limited by data storage and data crunching limitations. So in some sense, that field has been free to free their imaginations and develop innovations where those imaginations might take them, including real world applications. So as our society has complexified and all of these issues that we're facing on a daily basis, then those needs drive those innovations also in a virtuous cycle, I believe. So I think there's this perfect positioning of need and supply and demand on the AI side, which is of course driven fundamentally by human curiosity and a need to understand how the biological system accomplishes these tasks also. So I think it's a combination of all of these things.
Right, and your own work, you look at how AI can inform our understanding of memory and learning and decision making. So how do you do that, or how does that work in your research?
So I can start with a concrete example of one such project in my lab, right? That kind of sits exactly at this intersection between the exploration for artificial intelligence and the search for natural intelligence. And this project is actually, it's called curriculum learning and how we can use curriculum learning to probe learning and generalization mechanisms on the biological side of the biological brain. And so it's this fundamental search to say, well, how do we learn these incredible repertoire of tasks and behaviors that we're capable of performing? And so the way that we've been currently doing this is by looking at experts, right? Like, I would go to Juilliard and imagine this amazing violinist playing, and then I would try to infer how they might have learned. And that's somehow how we're building our artificial models also to learn. But this turns out to be kind of a narrow scope. So in fact, it's only by following the learning trajectory do you really understand how learning has taken place. So we need to collectively broaden our horizons and try to understand how learning takes place by following the actual steps that are involved in this. So that, again, involves taking this innovation that was originally in artificial intelligence called curriculum learning, which, since it's the perfect world of math and physical sciences and engineering, their goals were a little bit different, right? Their goals are to build the perfect machine that can learn the most efficiently something. So that's what curriculum learning was originally devised for. On the biology side, we're also interested in the reverse problem, right? We care slightly less about this perfect performance because our biological organisms aren't completely imperfect. We don't remember everything perfectly. Memory has flaws. How we learn has flaws. Nobody does perfectly. Even the Juilliard violinist may, in practice, occasionally miss a note. And so for us, the interest is not the pursuit of this perfect algorithm or machine, but really to understand, given all the gnarly bits and pieces of the biological brain, how do we accomplish learning? Right? It's not despite, but it's really the mechanisms constrained by the limitations of the biological hardware that kind of drives us. So this is an example of where, even though our goals are fundamentally different, we can take and significantly extend the capabilities of something that was developed originally for engineering and use it for mechanism discovery on the neuroscience side. So that's an example.
Right. And as you mentioned there, it's sort of a bidirectional flow of information from the biology to the AI and vice versa. What stage do you think that the relative balance of that information flow is at the moment? Because sometimes it feels like it's more AI informing biology than vice versa. What's your take on that?
I have a somewhat controversial take on this, right? I think, like, if you look at the original AI models, they were indubitably driven by observations in biology, right? So they called them idealized neuron-like units. Yes, then since, you know, other forces that are really kind of not scientific, more sociopolitical, economic, those things have made us more orthogonal, these two fields, than we would like. I mean, both fields acknowledge that we need to talk more tightly. But since our goals are different, right? One is engineering and the other is biology, that we somehow seem to be headed in divergent directions. But I think that's a little bit of a myth. I think people self-identify as one or the other more strongly than at times. And if you follow any of the social media wars, you can get very polarizing opinions. But I think in my daily life, I work with people that have been trained I myself have been trained in the physical sciences with an engineering background, in fact, and I work with people from artificial intelligence and machine learning every day. They work with biologists. In fact, even large companies that are developing these amazing algorithms and pipelines have been driven towards the biological problems. You can take the example of protein folding, or even understanding cognitive problems like DeepMind does. So I think there's a little bit of truth to the fact that we are divergent, but it's not a divergent trajectory. It's that if you take a snapshot in time, we look like we're going after different things because the goals are different. But fundamentally, it's the same idea, is that we want to understand how natural and artificial intelligence work. So I think the state, it's very hard to summarize something that's growing that fast, but will have like decades long effect by just capturing the state of a system at one time point. But I think we're closer than we appear.
Yeah, and I think the same can be said of art and science, which often seem like they're heading in different directions, but they do talk to each other a lot. And you mentioned memory there and how fallible human memory is. Is the same true, or could the same be true of AI models of memory with false memories or misrememberings? Is that possible or likely, do you think?
So I view that, I'm going to use the very traditional definitions of just a machine that can, you know, that has memory features, right? That is a perfectly performing mathematical construct, right? So it has this perfect lookup table, if you will, of every, let's say we have all these instances or incidences that have happened in our past, right? So there's a number associated with these, there's a magnitude associated with this, and then there's a direction associated with these, right? Like, was it a positive event that happened? Was it a kind of negative tending event? And also how long it lasts. The machine remembers all of these events perfectly, but does not really assign those arrows to them, right? Right? It doesn't have the subjective social construct. It's not this embodied thing that has lived in these different contexts and so forth. So it needs us in the loop. So if I need to assign an emotional valence to one of these numbers on this perfect table, then I need to be able to go do that as an engineer working on these machines. So I can tell you a scenario. So, you know, our memories are incredibly unreliable, right? We think we remember things that are perfectly one way. And then you talk to someone who was also inhabiting the same sphere at the same time, and they remember a completely different recollection of this. And then you also see extreme examples where memories get put back in the brain in kind of incorrect valence, right? Like something that was mildly negative could have a massive weight when it gets restored into the brain. Like, for example, that happens with people that have PTSD. And so when that memory gets reactivated, it has this giant emotional jolt. So one would want that kind of memory tagging to be revised a little. So from that perspective, having a model that is capable of exhibiting this would be helpful. So, you know, we can fail and fail faster on an artificial construct, right? If we could have a machine that is capable of doing this kind of erroneous memory capture and restoration and extinction, then we can do that without additional burden to patients that are suffering from PTSD, for example. But to answer your question more succinctly this time around, I think, so the machine in its traditional definition, the AI engineering model, is a has perfect recall. It cannot by itself assign valence to these numbers that it has stored. We are imperfect. So we do store most of these things and then we forget things. In fact, forgetting is a key part of what makes us able to function. People that don't forget things actually have a disorder. But we're also, as we go along, able to assign these valence numbers, these weights to these memories. And then when we revisit them, we revise them constantly. So it's this weird thing that when we revisit the memory, you're constantly rewriting it. So we're imperfect in so many dimensions, but it's the imperfection that makes us beautiful and worthy of pursuit and understanding, I think. So yeah, that's the connection with memory, I think. It can have a very positive impact if we choose to direct it appropriately.
Yeah, and I think that flaw in quotes of the memory system is what allows us to update memories and, you know, add in new information that we encounter afterwards. So it's a necessary flaw to allow us to adapt to our environment. And it's fascinating to hear how models of memory differ and how you can try and incorporate some of these features into these models. So I suppose, does that make models of amnesia and forgetting and specific memory disorders possible as well in AI?
Absolutely. I think that is a powerful yet slightly underexplored direction, in my opinion. I think there's people that are thinking about it, they're working on this, but we still don't really have any breakthroughs in this direction. It's somehow, again, this effect that perhaps we're perceived as more siloed than we really are in truth, right? I mean, this is sort of considered, oh, translational, or, oh, it's sort of on this other silo. But really having, I wouldn't go so far as to call these digital twins, but having models of these disabilities where you can go in and reverse engineer things like mechanisms, where you can have multiple mechanisms floating around in the same engineering construct, will suddenly help us tackle these very complex neuropsychiatric issues, such as PTSD, for example. You brought up amnesia, traumatic brain injuries. All of these require some kind of repair mechanism. And I think we'll be able to open up all kinds of new therapies, not just pharmacological or invasive ones, but other things such as CBT or behavioral shaping and relearning of those skills. If we're able to capture those phenomena in a mechanistic way in these artificial models. But I think it's still an unexplored frontier.
Yeah, and it seems like all that would be required is maybe some additional conversations between clinicians and people working in different disorders or conditions to talk to AI researchers more.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think what it needs is, well, yes, we say that we should talk more, but honestly, what it needs is massive investments at the, you know, that says that have the infrastructure. We're free from silos. People that work on weird animals doing strange things, people that are clinicians that are very devoted to the care of their patients and have different day jobs and priorities, people like me that are biologists fundamentally, people that are really working in industrial labs on AI applications. We can get together and talk about these problems. It's more than the talking, right? We also need the structure in place that we can work there without silos.
Another topic that comes to mind often when people think of AI is around creativity. And, you know, most recently, we've seen some of these incredible advances in image generation from DALL-E 2 and some of the other engines. How would you define the processes at work there? And can it be considered creativity under normal definitions? Or what's your view on that?
So I think, so machines can certainly be trained to exhibit patterns that are different from the ones that they were directly trained on, right? I mean, we would call this generalization. If it just goes from one type of bicycle to another type of bicycle, then it's sort of in-domain generalization. If it goes from bicycle to motorcycle, then all of a sudden you're talking slightly out of domain generalization. So it's a continuum. So I think when we start to constrain these models through experimental data from neuroscience experiments or from clinical data, then I think we'll be able to see that next leap to creativity in AI. We need to challenge those machines with examples that are much more real world, is the point. So for example, one of the projects in my lab, we call the state tracker. Is there's this phenomenon that people see when patients are in the neurosurgical ICU. So they've had some procedure done and they're largely immobile. And they have all of these probes that are emitting time series. So they monitor intracranial pressure, they monitor heart rate variability, they measure fluid outputs, they measure their reactivity and so forth, right? All of these get fed into this device that is supposed to raise an alarm every time one of these crosses some kind of upper bound or lower bound, like a threshold that says danger. So alarm fatigue is a phenomenon in clinical medicine where you see that these alarms just keep going off and patients don't get rest. And at some point, this is the limitation of the biological system, right? How many numbers going through the screen am I able to track and make a clinical judgment? The machine has perfect recall, right, as we discussed. So that machine can now take all of these time series, terabytes of data that are coming from one patient over 3 or 4 days, right? And it will be able to see patterns in these moving wiggles that we cannot see, right? So what it can do is to correlate these different time series with behavioral changes in the person, predict things like recovery, predict things like how soon should they become ambulatory. That sort of prediction, which is currently eluding clinicians, except for experience. So currently, we're just limited by these incredible people who've had years of experience treating these patients and making judgment calls. But we could help them out a little bit by designing machines that are able to make these predictions. And that, to me, is creative. Right? That is truly creative. It's not saying I'm going to make a thing and then, sell it to people. But this is a little bit more that is a much more hands-on application that is both constrained by data, but in a very quick feedback loop is used on real data that's being collected and kind of tossed every day in major hospitals all over the world.
So finally, let me just ask, where do you see computational neuroscience and AI heading in the next few years?
I think that's a really interesting question, given the fact that both of these fields, I mean, all of these fields are slowly sort of coalescing into working together and turning into this one mega super band. I think it's very hard to predict the trajectory exactly, but I think we will undoubtedly change human lives. And I think for the better. Yes, we'll have to skirt ethics and do that in a responsible fashion, but I think we could potentially conceive of intelligent approaches to solving some true crises in the planet, right? Like we can truly think about therapies for things that have been currently intractable. We can think of climate solutions. I mean, those types of really large problems. So one of the things I'll tell you, right? Like, when you go on a bus or a train or something and you're sitting next to someone, the first thing they talk to you is, well, what do you do for a day job? And then you tell them you're a neuroscientist. If they're not in the sciences or whatever, their first question inevitably is something about intelligence, something about consciousness, right? They ask the really big questions that have been, so essentially we kind of waffle, or basic answer right now is we don't know. Those questions are too hard. Or if you're feeling reflexive and defensive, you would kind of dismiss those neurophilosophical type questions. But I think given the pace of growth on the artificial intelligence side, on the neuroscience experimental side, and on the clinical side with the amount of data that is now becoming available, and the fact that we all live in hypersensed environments, we have this amazing confluence that is coming up. So we might actually have a better answer than, I don't know, it's too hard, to these truly big questions. I foresee that in the next like 5, 10 years. That'd be very cool though. Ambitious, but cool.
It does. It sounds really exciting, and it'll be fascinating to see where it does go. So Kanaka, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's been a delight.
Thank you for listening to the FENSCast. Before you go, FENS would like to remind you that regular registration for the Brain Conference will close on 14 June. Also, don't forget to apply for the FENS Hertie Winter School before 26 June. FENS offers 10 travel grants of 2,000 euros each to attend Neuroscience 2023, the Society for Neuroscience's annual meeting taking place from 11 to 15 November in Washington, D.C. FENS members can also present an abstract and register for Neuroscience 2023 under the same conditions as regular SFN members. Don't miss the opportunity to apply for an ISM slot code. Both calls will close on 14 June. Don't forget to send your nominations for the Chika and Heinz Schaller Foundation Award in Translational Neuroscience before 12 July. Thank you for listening, and join us for the next episode of FENSCast. Don't forget to follow us on FENS.org, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, and YouTube.